The next case on this morning's call is number 044247, Russell Martin against Groshans.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Hennick. I represent Russell Martin on this appeal. The issue before the Court is whether Mr. Martin was denied the effective assistance of counsel and is entitled to habeas relief based on his trial counsel's failure adequately to respond or to object to three types of or three inflammatory tactics used by the prosecutor to try to bolster the one witness case that they had against Mr. Martin. Obviously, ineffectiveness requires both deficient performance and resulting prejudice. This is also complicated by the anti-terrorism amendments, which require that when there is a decision on the merits, habeas relief is not appropriate unless the state decision is either contrary to or an unreasonable application of controlling U.S. Supreme Court precedent. What makes this complicated is that the State Court of Appeals, which is a controlling decision in this case, decided deficient performance on one of the issues, prejudice on two of the other issues. As we discussed in the brief, they applied the wrong standard for prejudice. I tried to make it more simple for the Court by including a chart within the brief showing which parts were decided by the Court of Appeals, which parts were not, and what standards to apply. Basically, the three issues we're raising, the three what we view as inflammatory tactics by the state. Number one, calling an ex-prosecutor to testify that Mr. Martin, while he was employed in Florida with a parish in Florida, they were trying to come up with a policy to deal with, respond to when an individual alleged sexual impropriety by a priest. And this ex-prosecutor testified at trial that Mr. Martin took an inappropriately aggressive view that we should be protecting priests against false allegations. That's number one. Number two, the state called a police officer for, as far as I can tell, the sole purpose was to testify that he went down to Florida from Wisconsin. He knew that Mr. Martin was represented by counsel at the time. He knew that the counsel had advised Martin not to talk about the case, and just telling the jury that these facts had happened, that Martin was represented by counsel, and that on the advice of counsel, he chose not to speak with the officer other than just general background questions. Third, at the time of closing arguments, the prosecutor, in an attempt to undermine the fact that Reverend Martin had 10 or 11 character witnesses attesting to his good character to corroborate his testimony that he did not, in fact, commit these offenses, invoked the names of Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Oswald. She went to so far as to talk about Jeffrey Dahmer's having boiled heads in his kitchen, things that obviously had absolutely no place whatsoever in this kind of a case. The State Court of Appeals, in a very rare action, actually admonished the trial prosecutor for that, that it was inappropriate, but ultimately deemed it not prejudicial. I think for the reasons stated in the brief, it should be clear that there was deficient performance here. There was no possible rational, legitimate relevance to any of this. I think the central issue on this appeal has to be prejudice, resulting prejudice.
You mean no objection was taken to the introduction of those pieces of evidence or to the argument of counsel during trial?
Argument of counsel, there was no objection. One thing I should make clear, we are not alleging that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to object during the closing argument. He had a reasonable basis for not objecting at the time. He believed that it would merely enhance the prejudice of the Dahmer and Oswald allegations. Where the ineffectiveness comes in, that he did not subsequently move for a mistrial outside the presence of the court of the jury. The Gilbreth, that was the ex-prosecutor, he objected on four or five different grounds. He testified at the post-conviction motion hearing that he knew that there was something wrong, he just didn't come up with the right answer or the right objection. With regard to Moranchek, Officer Moranchek, that's the police officer, He did not object to that. He agreed again at the post-conviction hearing that this was irrelevant and he didn't have any strategic or tactical reasons for not objecting. He just didn't do it. The one possible issue, the state did not challenge the deficient performance branches for the summation or the officer in the trial court. The one possible argument here on with regard to deficient performance is the ex-prosecutor. The state argued in the state court and also the Court of Appeals held that this could be relevant to consciousness of guilt, that he was that a jury could view this as Reverend Martin trying to protect himself. What the court overlooks, however, the Court of Appeals overlooks, however, is that there's no possible rational connection between his actions in Florida 6 years after the supposed incident and about a year before he ever learned about the allegations, and trying to either protect himself from discovery in Wisconsin or prosecution in Wisconsin. Setting up a policy for a particular parish in Florida concerning new allegations has absolutely nothing to do with an allegation that 6 years earlier he had sexually assaulted a young man in Wisconsin. On the issue of prejudice, the state Court of Appeals applied the wrong standard. Under Strickland, the question is whether there's a reasonable probability of a different result. The state Court of Appeals required the defense to show that there would have been a different result. Obviously, that's different. Mr. Groshans suggests that that might have just been sloppiness on the part of the Court of Appeals. But I think when we have a state court decision, we have to rely on what it actually says. And this was, as indicated in our reply brief, at a time when the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, in fact, was requiring defendants to show more than simply a reasonable probability of a different result. This court in Washington v. Smith took them to task for that, pointed out that this is not what the Supreme Court requires. But that didn't happen until I think it was 3 or 4 months after the decision in this case. The combined effect of allegations of summation, Jeffrey Dahmer, who had sexually assaulted young men, killed them, and had boiled heads and bodies in his apartment shortly after the whole thing with Mr. Dahmer came out, could not help but prejudice this case where Reverend Martin is alleged to have sexually assaulted a 13-year-old boy. When that's combined with two types of evidence which, although not rationally providing a consciousness of guilt or evidence of consciousness of guilt, a lay jury could determine suggests consciousness of guilt. You combine those, a combined effect, I think, is that there is a reasonable probability of a different result in this case and that Martin was denied his rights to effective assistance of counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. In Alvarez v. Boyd, a case cited in Martin's briefs, this court admonished reviewing courts to be careful not to magnify the significance of trial errors, which had little importance in the trial setting. And a defendant in a criminal matter is entitled to a fair trial, not a perfect one. This court's admonition, I think, is important in this case. Even if this court concludes that trial counsel performed deficiently, Martin has not shown any reasonable probability that but for these errors, the trial result would have been different. The state court of appeals, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, concluded in pertinent part with respect to Denise Gilbreth's testimony that Martin's trial counsel did not perform deficiently because this evidence was relevant and admissible under state law to prove Martin's consciousness of guilt. The AEDPA standards plainly apply to this particular finding, and the state court's finding of no deficient performance is not an unreasonable application of Strickland. Throughout this litigation, at least at the appellate level, Martin has stated his belief that consciousness of guilt evidence is limited solely to acts that are intended to avoid or obstruct punishment, and that's just not correct. In Edmonds versus Depish, this court held that demeanor evidence was admissible to prove guilty knowledge, that it was in fact a jury question. That ultimately is what we have with respect to Gilbreth's testimony in this case. Martin's counsel urges one conclusion from the evidence. The prosecution in the case urged a different conclusion. The jury was put in its position, its rightful position, of deciding between those two competing inferences. Martin reacted inappropriately and angrily to a very unremarkable policy proposal that was being suggested in his parish, a proposal that called for immediate involvement of police and social services in any situation where a parish priest or a parish employee was accused of sexual misconduct.
Is there any case that you can think of where a position taken by a fellow like this in before a charge has been filed has been introduced as an evidence of consciousness of guilt?
I was not able to find a case specifically on point, either in Wisconsin jurisprudence or in other jurisprudence.
So the Wisconsin law that you've described is based on something of a vacuum in the area in which...
In this case, I think the decisions were reached on applications of basic propositions of relevancy. I mean, Wisconsin has cases that talk about admission of evidence as consciousness of guilt.
Consciousness of guilt, something like fleeing or reacting inappropriately to an accusation, that sort of thing. But that was not true in this case.
I am aware of one case where...
Could he take the abstract position that... Excuse me. Forgive me. I'm obviously excited. If he takes an abstract position, he thinks priests are entitled to be defended and that they should scrutinize complaints more carefully, that he has now indicated, under Wisconsin law, in your theory at least, an indication of guilt.
I say that the evidence that he acted inappropriately to that policy...
Of course, the question of appropriate or inappropriate depends on who's listening to it.
Absolutely.
If his position is perfectly properly held, that we ought to look at these things pretty carefully, look them over because they're so easy to accuse, he'd still be stuck with that.
The first line of inquiry, though, Judge Bauer, is not this court. It's the jury.
I'm saying the introduction of the evidence is what bothers me, not what the jury decides on the subject of the matter. The officer testified in her position that the priest acted inappropriately.
Correct. And was asked to explain the nature of that inappropriate reaction, which we detailed in the...
Yes, I understand that. But, I mean, that is a subjective discussion all by itself.
Yes. Yes, I agree with you. It is a subjective determination, but it is one that the prosecution was able to provide, by my lights, a very reasoned and reasonable explanation. He was reacting badly because he was aware, acutely aware, of his own sexual improprieties. Now, the defense is obviously free to argue a second interpretation of that evidence, but that's what we call juries for, to make those determinations.
Assuming just... bearing with me momentarily, that the accusation against him was inappropriate, was untrue. That you have inhibited anybody from taking a position that he did take in his discussion down there, even if you're totally innocent.
I respectfully disagree. I think that...
And if I suggest in a closed meeting that I think it would be more appropriate for the government to be put to a greater test, for instance, for a particular crime... and I was subsequently charged with such a crime, that would be able to be introduced against me as an indication that I was guilty of, or had guilty knowledge of, my future accusation.
I'm not sure I follow your analysis, but I guess to recast it, if you were to express an opinion similar to the one that was expressed here, I think that admits of one possible explanation. It may admit of other explanations.
But
that's what we pay juries and advocates for, to argue the different inferences from evidence. And we cite in our brief the various cases that stand for the proposition that even equivocal evidence of consciousness of guilt is relevant and admissible.
That's why I got to the one where I wanted to know whether or not you ever had a case where some accusation was not pending when such evidence was then deemed to be admissible.
The only case that I can think of that comes close to this is a case that was recently published in Wisconsin called State versus, I think, Silva, where evidence was admitted as to a defendant's reaction during a sermon where there was a discussion of forgiveness in the face of sin, and I'm remembering this because it's my case. The defendant's complexion changed, and testimony was presented at trial as to his actions.
He blushed when somebody suggested he got to the sixth commandment.
I think they described it as yellowish in his response. But again, it went to the jury, and the jury was entitled to analyze it and give it the weight that it deserves.
To keep your mouth shut, you have to be careful about whether you blush.
I'm into my second five. I would prefer to answer questions if the court has any remaining questions.
What was the status of the Martin when this Marinchek interviewed him?
I believe that he was aware of the allegations. I don't think he had been charged at that point.
Was he in any kind of custody?
No.
Well, is the issue his silence? Is that... whatever he did raised his eyebrow or something or other.
I think the parties possibly disagree over what the issue is. We treated it throughout this litigation as a allegation under Doyle versus Ohio, impermissible commentary on a witness's invocation of silence. All of the courts that looked at this noted the factual distinctions between Doyle in this case. Man wasn't in custody, hadn't been charged. But this court's jurisprudence, Martin then argues that it really isn't a Doyle situation, but it's an impermissible burdening or an impermissible commentary on the defendant's invocation of a right. Our argument is, first of all, it occurred as a very small portion of the trial. The prosecution didn't focus on it. It doesn't appear that it was made a focal point of the trial. I think at least one judge who considered this, it may have been the state trial judge, thought the evidence came in more as a part of the chronology of the events that the state undertook in its investigation than any particular attempt to comment on his silence. Again, evaluating it under Strickland, under the prejudice standard of Strickland, Marinchek's testimony on this point didn't subvert the defense. They didn't explicitly or implicitly invite the jury to infer guilt from what Russell didn't say at the time that this questioning occurred. The cases that Martin cites in his reply brief, Kalin and Sizemore, really are not on point. Kalin involved a Doyle violation. The Sizemore case, that's also cited in Martin's reply brief, involved, by any standards, egregious prosecutorial misconduct. The court found a due process violation in that case. Neither of the cases that he relies on really apply to the facts here. We move the remainder of our argument on brief. I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to Ms. Gilbreth, the issue is not simply whether the state's court's decision is contrary to Strickland, but also whether it's contrary to cases such as Leary v. United States, which held that there must be a rational connection between the proffered evidence and the desired inference. Now, Leary was a statutory presumption case, but the logic applies fully equally here, that we aren't just talking about any inference that somebody might pull out. It has to be a reasonable inference. And you cannot, I submit, go from, as Judge Bauer was discussing, somebody's advocacy in Florida 6 years after an alleged incident, that somehow that person is knows or is showing consciousness of being guilty for something he did half a continent away in 6 years earlier. He had not been informed of even the charges. So there is simply no rational connection there, and the state still has not suggested the string of inferences that you'd have to actually reach that rational connection. Edmonds, they cite as supporting them. Actually, Edmonds upheld exclusion of consciousness of guilt evidence. With regard to Marinchek, the police officer, we have not argued that this is specifically a Doyle case. We admit that in our brief. We never have argued that this is specifically Doyle because Martin was not in custody. So the specific conclusion in Doyle does not apply here. We are arguing, number one, that it is wholly irrelevant to present evidence that the defendant hired an attorney and on the advice of counsel remained silent is wholly irrelevant to anything, and only brings up the risk of prejudice that a lay person would take that as hiding behind your lawyer in order to show consciousness of guilt. Also, Moranchek is irrelevant. Also, under state law in Wisconsin, you don't have to get to Doyle. 905.13 bars evidence of the invocation of a privilege. So even without Doyle, it was improper.
Before you sit down, sir, in this case, I know that the cumulative effect of these errors was argued before the district court.
Yes.
Was it argued before the state courts?
Yes, it was. And if you look at the very last paragraph of the state court decision, they specifically refer to the fact that we are saying you should look at the cumulative effect, and they say, but we're not going to do that because we only found two errors, and the other two we didn't find to be prejudicial individually, and we're not going to decide whether it was cumulatively prejudicial.
Thank you very much. Sir, did you serve by appointment?
No.
You're not. Well, in any event, both you and your colleague have the thanks of the court for your fine presentations. The court has one more case on its call today, but it necessitates a change in the panel. The court is going to take a 15 to 20 minute recess, and we will be back to hear the last case of the day.